Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve is in conversation with journalist Jamie Bartlett, a specialist in online culture and technology, and the author of several books, including The People vs. Tech, How the Internet is Killing Democracy, and Radicals Chasing Utopia, Inside the Rogue Movements Trying to Change the World. Jamie Bartlett also writes and hosts the hit BBC podcast series The Missing Crypto Queen, which uncovers the story of Dr. Ruja Ignatova, the woman who promised to make millions rich through a cryptocurrency called OneCoin before her disappearance after bilking billions of euros. Steve and Jamie discuss current trends in cybercrime and what government, private companies, and individuals can do to fight back.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks very much for stopping by and talking to me today. Good to see you.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been researching and writing about the dark web and cyber criminals for quite some time now. Have you seen an evolution during your time of looking at this particular space and what's been going on with regard to the tactics that they're using? How's it evolved? Tell us about that.
Well, I always look at it really from sort of quite basic human behavior. I mean, these are people that are smart, they're creative, they're very responsive. So when I look at the dark web and how it changes over the years, I always make some prediction that X is going to happen, and it never does. Because law enforcement turns up, suddenly they change their approach.
Right.
So for example, on the dark web at the very beginning, it was all very sort of centralized marketplaces where you could buy and sell stolen data.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is it, this is the future. Then law enforcement starts to crack down on them quite well, and they disintegrate, they regroup, they come back again more decentralized and harder to close down, so they adapt with the technology. Then they go into more private closed forums where they can chat amongst themselves, mm-hmm. a lot harder for us to monitor what they're doing. And so it's not so much a specific basic evolution, it's more a constant sort of creative, in a way that any business does, a creative analysis of the landscape. And they're just working every bit as hard as any of us are. They're thinking in the same way that we are. So one thing I've noticed, for example, is that I think they're getting better at spotting how to respond to current events.
Okay.
COVID being a case in point, mm-hmm. I hadn't really predicted just how much they would all suddenly shift to COVID-related scams on the darknet. So within days of it happening, everyone's receiving text messages from scammers. You probably mm-hmm. remember a lot
yeah.
of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying, click here to get your Omicron booster.
Yeah.
And the speed, like far quicker than we were able to roll it out. I mean, they mm-hmm. were so quick. So I feel like they're getting a lot better at responding to current events. And the reason for that is I think so much of cybercrime in my mind is really about criminals using basic cognitive tricks.
Right.
You know, it's really about, forget the technology for a second, it's making you not concentrate for a second, have a sense of urgency, mm-hmm. make a little mistake. And they exploit that brilliantly. And I feel like as the years go by, they're just getting better at working out how we think rather than necessarily just the technical changes that we see.
So how do we deal with that? I mean, because they do, it isn't just big corporates that are being targeted, right? You made the point. It's you, it's me, it's everybody. And we're all much more technology enabled, we use it all the time for everything. And that opens up the opportunity for them, doesn't it? So from a sort of, you know, really simple user perspective, what are the sorts of things that people should do?
Yeah, I try increasingly to just tell people to think about it in two ways. The first is, I mean, obviously you've got to, it pays to be a little bit paranoid, pays to be a little bit skeptical. Anything strange, anything that doesn't feel right, anything that just something looks a bit off, an email you're not expecting, mm-hmm. obviously all that basic stuff. But think about it emotionally as well. Are you being put under pressure to do something? Are you being sort of forced to respond to the CEO's email extremely quickly in a way that you weren't expecting? Are they trying to exploit your sort of human cognitive weaknesses as well as your technical ones. And some of that, I think, for sort of IT professionals, it always feels like so much of the job is just getting everyone on side, everyone in the organization to be a bit more careful. And I think one of the great ways to do that is to allow people to be slightly honest. Mm-hmm. Good friends of mine, extremely tech-savvy people, have fallen for the classic HMRC, you've got a tax rebate scam.
Right. Yep.
People who I never would have thought would have been sucked in by that. Why? Because they are so excited at the prospect of getting a tax rebate. And they don't even have self-assessment. I had an email from a phone call from a friend who said, great news, I've got a tax rebate. And I said, what are you talking about? Yeah, I just got an email about it. I filled it all in. I thought, oh, my goodness me. Now, I think it's really good for people to be honest about that and tell other people so you don't feel stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it gets people really, yeah, any of us can fall for this stuff.
Yeah.
And rather than going into the specifics of, well, you need an automated, you know, defense system, you need to check every other day for exfiltration efforts and, yeah, all of that stuff that IT professionals do. But for me, it's also about just being a bit open and honest about everyone's subject to this. Everyone can fall for it. So don't feel bad. Just be a bit more careful.
And that's probably even more important now that we're moving much more into hybrid working, remote working, being the regular way of operating, right? Because it isn't about I go to work and I use a work machine. No, we're using the same machines. We're actually doing things at the same time because everybody's really good at ordering stuff on Amazon while they're still doing their spreadsheets and everything else. And so again, big opportunity for people to exploit that. So this honesty thing is really important.
Absolutely. And that is actually one of the big differences I've noticed on the dark web. Just mentioned it there. So many people use their work email addresses for their personal stuff.
Right.
And I wonder whether being at home makes that a little easier to do because mm-hmm. you're on your computer. You might be already logged into your work email. So you think, well, I'll just quickly use it for X, Y, or Z. But then suddenly that system gets hacked into, that database gets lost. Your work email and password is now available. And it gives people a way into the work environment. And I think when you're at home and the boundaries are slightly more blurred, mm-hmm. people are more likely to do that. And I see more and more, I mean, work emails appearing on darknet sites for sale. And I partly suspect it's because more people are using them for the things they shouldn't at home. So there's some pretty basic stuff like that, really. Don't use your work email to log into Netflix or whatever it happens to be, some strange gaming site that you've joined because you were bored for 10 minutes, because that really can come back to haunt you, the whole organization.
But what about people using it, maybe, deliberately, because they know that the work email should be more protected than the personal email? Have you thought about that?
So you mean that the people are using it because they think it's a safer one to use?
Yeah.
Well, maybe it is, but I'm not sure whether they should. I'm not sure whether the boss would thank them for that.
I think that the point there is that we, you know, if we're going to combat these sorts of things, we've got to do a much better job about getting inside the heads of why people do what they do.
Yeah, that's true.
To understand it, because I think we can make assumptions that maybe are not what they are. We touched a little bit on sort of the role of the organisation in that, but I want to switch up a bit and talk about government. Lots of people talk to me about the role of government and, you know, government should be legislating and government should be doing this, that and the other to protect us all in this environment. And for me, that some of that stems from a lack of understanding of the fact that when you go onto the internet, you know, it is not a safe environment. It's never been a safe environment. For some reason, we've always assumed it is, and I'm not quite sure how that happened. But do you think there's a role for governments to play in better regulation or doing a lot more, perhaps, through the education system to raise the level of awareness to help people in this space? What's your take on the role that government has to play?
Yeah, when I think about the dark web, they're always struggling to prosecute crimes. So, you know, classically, crime used to be much more of a geographical issue. So mm-hmm. it would be sort of hand to hand. A house is burgled and it's usually someone close by. A shop is burgled. Yeah. Your premises are broken into. Police, the jurisdiction's clear who's responsible. And then they can start sort of, you know, they're set up to work in these specific geographical areas. And then suddenly they're trying to find criminals that are based on the other side of the world. And it's extremely frustrating for the victims of cybercrime to just simply be told over and over, there is nothing we can do.
Right.
And I can't really see a way around that. So it has to come back, rather than prosecution, to preparedness, mm-hmm. to training, to, in some cases, I think where the government can really help is, yes, educational training is going to be great, but there's always a limit to how good that's ever going to be, of course. I know the police make much more effort now than they did a decade ago at working with especially smaller companies, going in there and teaching them about the latest trends in cybercrime, what things to look out for. And that is particularly helpful because I think over the last 2 years, so many companies have basically been forced to go online and essentially become e-commerce sites.
Yes.
Every single mum and pop bakery are now essentially online companies because they had to during lockdown.
Mm.
And I'm sure you've seen it. Suddenly a lot more companies coming to you for advice because they never expected to be processing payments online and dealing with all of this stuff. So the focus on the smaller companies, I think, is going to be really important in the next couple of years. Default settings is the one thing I think where government can help. This might be something more in the home.
Mm.
When you talk about what the default password setting is on things, the sort of privacy by default, internet-enabled devices which are going to proliferate very, very quickly. I don't think it's much to ask manufacturers to basically set things up with very, very hard, complex passwords immediately rather than 1, 2, 3, 4,
mm-hmm.
because we know how few people actually bother changing them once they're set up.
Yep.
Encouraging a kind of better practice right at the beginning. That's the sort of thing government can do. You've got to look for the things they can do because, like I said, I think prosecution is... You know, I mean, actually stopping this crime is next to impossible, I'm afraid. I imagine they will begin to invest more in various insurance-based models to try to...
Right.
How do we deal with very, very large cybercrime where it's, you know, millions and millions of dollars have been stolen?
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance is always going to be part of that. And I think government's probably going to have to incentivize insurance companies to do more there. But they're still working it out, aren't they? They're still working out what role do they best play?
Yeah.
Because it's really not obvious.
Yeah. And it's a fine balance for them as well. And, you know, where they end up on that, I suspect, will be determined by a whole range of different elements, not least cultural. Because there are some countries where it's, yes, they will naturally take a much more front foot approach than perhaps others that will be sitting back a bit more and saying, well, actually, no, the responsibility is yours.
I have found, though, to give them some credit, again, I was extremely pessimistic about the ability of policing on the dark net.
Mm.
I feel like they're getting much better at, I suppose you could think of it as old-fashioned policing, but in a virtual space.
Right.
You know, actually getting into these forums, going undercover,
mm-hmm.
becoming sellers and buyers themselves, working out how they operate these marketplaces for stolen data, for example, starting to undermine confidence in the system by, let's say, for example, you know, the markets on the darknet operate like Amazon with user reviews.
Yep.
So you go on there and start messing with the user review system, giving everyone 1 star out of 5 rather than 5.
Yep.
Slowly working your way up the organization, collecting data and then prosecuting people. And you've seen that's got a lot better. And that's encouraging because when I speak to the sort of police or the authorities, I always say, you probably have some amazingly talented, very young bobbies that have joined, that are 23 years old, they've just started, you've put them on the beat.
Mm-hmm.
You might have an incredibly gifted gamer here who actually understands how this works.
Yeah.
Why don't you find what skills they've got?
Yeah.
They'll understand how the cyber culture works in gaming communities and where crime might take place and stick them on that instead. So I think there's a wealth of talent as the 22, 23, 24, 25-year-olds are joining schools and joining the police. I don't think we're tapping into it enough yet. So that's a practical thing I think police could do better.
What about the collaboration piece, law enforcement across jurisdiction? You know, one of the challenges they've always faced is, to your point, that cybercriminals don't just sit in one location. They're spread around the world. And they do know those areas that are better for them to be established than others. What are the sorts of things that you've seen law enforcement do better in terms of collaborating across those jurisdictions?
Yeah. It's obviously very hard if you're talking about corporate espionage in China, you know, sort of totally uncontrollable cybercrime from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little we're actually able to do about that, frankly. They have been better, though, with... On, again, I come back to the dark web, because mm-hmm. it's the area I sort of know well. Within the dark web, actually quite a lot of the sort of people running these marketplaces or key sellers are often based in the Netherlands, Ireland, the UK, the US, places where we do have cooperation between mm-hmm. authorities. And Europol in particular has taken a bit of a lead at trying to coordinate investigations into particular dark web sites and particular dark web people. For a period, they were actually running some of these marketplaces. Mm-hmm. They take them over and then run them to gather as much intelligence as they could and then coordinate mass arrests, right. sort of pretty impressive multi-jurisdictional operations. That is something that didn't really happen much 10 years ago. And in a way, the sort of the multi-jurisdictional nature of the dark web has forced police authorities around the world, where they can, to actually work together. And it is much better than it was. But it's, again, I come back to the fact that it's still quite limited. I mean, what I see, because I think the authorities understand how difficult it is for them, more and more what you might call exemplary punishments, mm-hmm. extremely tough punishments to warn people off this career in cybercrime,
right.
because you're only going to catch a tiny number of them and the job is to stop more people joining. But I'm worried as well about what a long-term recession could do. Have we had a major economic downturn in a world where we were sort of all reliant on digital technologies? I don't think, I mean, when was the last one really?
Yeah, I don't think we have.
The 90s?
90s would have been the worst, I think. And certainly, if you look at the way that digital environment is today versus then, there's no resemblance, does it?
Yeah. So I wonder what effect that might have on whether it will draw more people into the industry of cybercrime. Because let's face it, you can go onto a dark website, download some pretty cheap ransomware, download 500,000 email addresses, send the ransomware, your double, triple extortion techniques that you guys have written about.
Yeah.
It's a money-making opportunity.
Yeah, it is.
And you're a 22-year-old who's out of work and is looking for something. I just wonder whether high levels of unemployment and economic downturn could have quite an impact on the cybercrime sector in a way we maybe haven't thought about because we've never really seen it before.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound pessimistic, but I'm not quite sure we know what the effect of a recession is on cybercrime, but it, unfortunately, probably not a good one.
You're probably right. And I think the other sad thing is we're probably going to find out.
Yeah,
so, put a research hat on and good news.
sadly, there's a learning opportunity there, unfortunately.
Let's talk about the payment side of things, because you touched on there ransomware as a service, you know, the ability to buy it. How are these things being bought? What's the currency? Crypto, presumably.
Yeah, cryptocurrency, as it always really has been, because it's the most convenient way to pay. So you both buy ransomware software, essentially. Often it's sort of licensed from someone. There's all sorts of interesting business arrangements where you can split the money, you know, split the takings, mm-hmm. if you like. So someone builds the software for you, you take on the risk, you find the email addresses, you set up some of the wallets, but you split the profits 50-50 because you're not the guy that can actually write the software for the ransomware.
Right.
Because we all know that increasingly, and this is another change, more and more, I call it like democratization of crime.
Mm-hmm.
It's just easier and easier to do. In the same way that it's easier for me to post my tweets and, you know,
yeah.
publish my work, yeah. it's easier to get involved in cybercrime. So much more is sort of click and play and plug-in stuff. And then, of course, yeah, I mean, you're paying the ransomware. If people decide to pay, you're nearly always paying in Monero or Dash or Zcoin, Bitcoin, all of the cryptocurrencies. I can't see that really changing because that is the way criminals... It's the easiest way for them to receive the money, of course.
Mm. And probably going to remain that way for some while to come, I guess.
I can't imagine it changing. I mean, cryptocurrency has, for some years now, I think it's tried to move away from its sort of criminal past because for a while it really was only the darknet markets where it's ransomware, drugs, stolen data, personally identifiable information being bought and sold and in quite an astonishing volume. And that seemed to be the main use case for Bitcoin. Now, of course, we have all sorts of speculative investment opportunities and blockchain-based databases, but it does remain important for very particular types of cybercrime, and ransomware is the key one, and I can't see that changing. Because every time there is a downturn in the price of Bitcoin, it doesn't really matter that much for the criminal. They'll just increase how much Bitcoin they ask for.
Right.
So it doesn't really make much difference to them.
Yeah. And you've done a lot of work recently in terms of investigating that whole sort of space, OneCoin in particular. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so really for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been investigating and exposing what is maybe the biggest cryptocurrency scam of all time. It's essentially, an old-fashioned pyramid Ponzi scheme, but just using a fake cryptocurrency as the product. And for 4 or 5 years, something like 1 million people invested at least 4 billion euros into a cryptocurrency that did not exist.
Right.
And then in 2017, the founder, the genius founder behind this, Dr. Ruja Ignatova, went on the run, disappeared. And funnily enough, only about 2 months ago, she appeared on the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list. Mm-hmm. So she is the only crypto scammer ever to be on that list. And she's now one of the most wanted people in the world. I never knew that was where the story was going to end up when I started, because I probably wouldn't have got into it, to be honest. Sort of grew and grew and grew.
And what sort of people were sucked in? I mean, you said it was like a Ponzi scheme. Ponzi schemes traditionally take everybody. You know, you can't categorize who gets involved in that. Were there any people who were particularly susceptible to this, or was it?
I would say generally it was people that weren't technically minded. People that didn't really understand cryptocurrency that well, but had read an article saying it was the future of money, had seen their neighbor getting rich because they happened to have bought Bitcoin in 2013.
Right.
So not sophisticated investors, ordinary people, but smart people. I've seen a doctor, a surgeon who invested $900,000 in a fake cryptocurrency. I've seen people with PhDs in finance invest in a fake Ponzi, a Ponzi scheme, essentially.
Yeah.
And it speaks to, I think, obviously, the wider lesson here is these were scammers see when there's suddenly a new technology that turns up. The technical people understand it, but ordinary people start rushing in afterwards and they don't really understand it very well. And they make basic mistakes. And this is true of cybercrime as well. We're suddenly all online. Mm-hmm. The IT specialists know the risks, but most of us don't. And that is how we get caught out. And so much of the scam there was, again, in the same way that all cyber criminals do, was based on playing to your human weaknesses, playing to your need to, your hope that you were going to make money very quickly and having just 10 minutes to invest in this opportunity and you've got to do it now. And it all looks very legitimate. It all looks very believable.
Right.
And falling for it.
And that probably, sadly, is the world in which we're going to continue to live going forward. So what are 2 or 3 top tips that you could give people who are listening here to avoid falling into some of these traps that we've just been talking about?
Well, I always think it's very important for the people that have... You learn when you make a mistake.
Right.
That's the best way. I don't know about you, but I talk about fear of missing out and how urgency and fear of missing out are the key emotional weaknesses that we all suffer from that cyber criminals try to exploit. Omicron, you've got 15 minutes to fill this in to get your injection, and people are panicked and they're worried, and it looks absolutely identical to the NHS website. And I understand why people fall for that, and I think anyone that does suddenly learns the lesson. It's incumbent on everyone that has fallen for it to not be silent and feel stupid, but to tell everyone they know. I know it's hard. Go and tell everyone you know that you fell for this scam,
right?
Because that is the way people will remember. And they'll learn. And when I did a big episode about someone, an IT specialist at a big company that had to deal with the aftermath of a massive ransomware attack, it's never going to happen to that company again.
Yeah.
I mean, because suddenly all their systems have completely transformed. They've locked off different parts of the organization so it can't spread as quickly. So I'm always looking for, when the worst does happen, it's your chance. You've got a window to tell everyone about it, to learn about it, to change your practices. And the way that cybercrime is going, I think they're just going to get smarter and smarter at exploiting those human weaknesses. So seeing is not believing.
Mm-hmm.
Never think because something looks right, it must be right. The thing about OneCoin and all the crypto scammers is they look perfect.
Right.
They look identical to the real thing.
Yeah.
If you have any doubt or concern at all and you feel like you're being rushed or you feel like you're uncomfortable, just stop, wait. It's pretty simple. For companies themselves, I always think, for me anyway, preparedness is everything because it's so hard to stop this stuff. you know, it's so hard to stop it. But what you can do is be prepared for when things go wrong. I think increasingly as more of our lives are digital and ordinary people care more and more about their digital data and their digital footprint, it will be increasingly unforgivable for companies that don't take it seriously, that haven't done, you know, haven't encrypted customer data properly,
right,
that haven't taken their responsibilities seriously, that didn't have a backup plan, that didn't, all the good stuff that you teach every single week. Any company that doesn't do that, just imagine yourself up, and I'm a journalist, imagine yourself up in front of the journalist saying, so what happened then? Why did you, did you not know that, you know, it was good to have a backup in place? And I think actually as more crime becomes more automated, which we all expect it will do, any slight weakness or vulnerability probably will be exploited at some point, and then backup becomes everything.
Yeah.
You know, preparedness. And that is also a media plan. How do you deal with the annoying journalists knocking at your door reputationally as well? So, yeah, so there's obviously different bits of advice at different parts of the stack of people. But for me, that caution, that honesty, and that preparedness are really critical.
Fantastic. Jamie, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for sharing those insights. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to this week's guest, Jamie Bartlett. We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, as always, we ask that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a little more time, you can even write a quick review. That helps other listeners who might enjoy our content find us. And we also want to make sure to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen. And, of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.